I'm sure many of our listeners saw recently on public television the movie about you and your late husband, Medgar Evers. What was your job in the making of that movie, and how did the movie come to be?
I think perhaps my job was that of troublemaker. In all honesty, I was on the scene most of the time during the filming of the show. And I was primarily interested in being as sure as possible that Medgar was portrayed properly and that the data would be as correct as possible, and that the movie would not be all Hollywood and be very factual. And that was basically my role. It was one that meant that I had to be on the set all of the time. It often meant that I had to critique and convince, if you will, the producer and the director to make some changes in it. It was a very, very interesting role. I learned a great deal. I did decide that that industry was not for me, that I would that I would prefer to remain in the world of business. But it was interesting. It was also very rewarding. I learned a great deal and made many, many friends. The movie itself was actually some 8 years in the making. It took that length of time to convince a production company that the life of Medgar Evers was indeed a story that the public would be interested in and that the public would watch. And, of course, coming from my perspective, something that the public needed. And with the help of the producer, Ken Rotkop, a man who really pushed for this movie over the years. As a matter of fact, he even pursued funding and whatnot when I had thrown up my hands, at least for the time, and felt that, well, it will be done in some time and place later. But it did take 8 years. And even up until the time of production, there were still some people who said that the time was not right. And my question with that to those people, after 20 years, the time is still not right.
What do you think they meant by that? What time were they looking for?
I think, really, they felt that there was no, if you will, black, in quote, market there, that the public really would not be interested in going back into the civil rights era of the 50s and the 60s. And, of course, coming from a production standpoint, they're looking for something that's very profitable, not for something that is going to be a service, if you will, because it is business and they have to, or at least hope to make a profit off of everything. Some 10 years after Medgar's death, I approached a number of individuals as well as television stations, whatnot. And I got the same thing. It's too soon. It's too soon to bring that up again. That was 10 years after Medgar's death. And I really could not understand that. And then to get some of the same feelings and statements 20 years later, then that's when my question, you know, well, when is the time? And for some people, I'm sure there never will be a time. But the film For Us the Living, the Medgar Evers story, had to be told. I hope that in the future it will be told more in depth, because that film took into consideration 10 years, the last 10 years of his life. And the public asked for more. The response was really tremendous.
What was it like for you to have yourself represented in the movie?
It was a little odd, but I must admit that I was so involved in Medgar being portrayed correctly that I really did not focus on myself. It was only after one of the scenes, Howard Rollins, by the way, played played the role of Medgar. But it was only after one of the scenes at a mass rally that both Howard and I looked at each other after that had been completed. And without words, we knew that the essence had been captured there. And it was only after that that I began to focus on the Merle character. And I was just really almost obsessed with the Medgar character, and that was it. And I really reacted only to Merle after I saw everything done and viewed the film.
And then
it was, yes, I guess so. There was a scene, however, that I really had to fight to have included. It was a scene where Medgar and Merle confronted each other about his activities. And I recall so vividly that part of our lives, and it was a turning point for us in our marriage. I did not want Medgar to pursue the activist role, only because I was afraid. I was afraid for his life, and I wanted as normal a home life as possible. The 9-to-5 kind of job, that kind of thing, because that had basically been my upbringing. Medgar was not that kind of person. I understand from friends and relatives he had been the kind of vocal activist type almost all of his life. So we had a confrontation, of which I told him that he had to make a decision whether he was going to be a good husband to me and a father to the children or not. And he turned it back to me and told me that I was the one who had to make a decision because he was about his job. He was about his commitment. And he could not fight the battle of his people and try to help his people overcome the fear that they had in terms of challenging the system, and then come home and have to deal with my disagreement in terms of his chosen profession. And interestingly enough, the producers did not want that in there. And I said, but you have to do that. You cannot show me as a very supportive person pulling Medgar along all of the way. It was really the opposite. And show the growth of two people. Show the conflicts and the growth in a marriage. Portray us accurately as human beings. And I really had to fight for that. And I'm so glad that I did, even though I've had people tell me, well, my goodness, I thought you were in the forefront all the time. And I said, no, I was not. I came from a very poor family, but in our little town, it was somewhat middle class because my parents were teachers. And I came from a background where one did not rock the boat. You simply achieved within the boundaries that were set for you. And I knew as a child that something was off about that. Something was wrong. But I did not really start moving into that until I met Medgar and until he turned me around in the sense that I would be willing to give up a regular type of job, a desirable home life, and be committed. And I ended up being, I was about to say, as committed as he. Not quite, but almost. I would have gladly given my life for him had I had a choice as to which one of us would have gone first. I would have stepped forward and said, no, let him stay here and do his work. But the commitment has grown over the years, and I was fully committed to everything, certainly by the time of his death and far before that.
What responsibility have you taken on yourself to carry on the work that you were doing together and to keep his name and his work in, to have it take its place in history that it deserves?
Well, I have, I've had to go about it in my own way. After Medgar was killed, I found that I could continue to exist. And in all honesty, I really thought that I would not be able to, because even though I have been criticized by some feminist a few years ago of saying this, I will repeat it and repeat it gladly. Medgar was my life. He and my children were my world, if you will. Not that I was not active and did not have some things of my own that I did, but they were the core. And the emotional shock of losing him and then finding myself responsible for Merle and three adorable children was quite a shock to me, and I had to forge ahead. I had made a decision that it was necessary to go back to school and get my degree so I could have an opportunity to compete in the working world. And that whole coming around and dealing with his death of moving from a totally black society into almost a totally white society when I made the move from Mississippi to California was, to put it very mildly, cultural shock. And I had all of the bitterness and even hatred in me at that time. I was able, through the help of a number of people, to focus that. And that's really when my open activism started. I really started off doing speaking engagements for the NAACP almost immediately after Medgar's death. I found myself in the forefront when I had always been very, very shy and had stayed in the background and played a very supportive role. But I toured the country speaking on behalf of the NAACP and Medgar, because I felt then that as long as I stayed before the public, as long as the public could see me, they would not forget Medgar. And that was the basis for my doing that. And that is indeed true. I certainly had the knowledge that we are human beings and that we forget very quickly. And I did not want Medgar forgotten overnight. So for a year and a half or so, I traveled constantly on behalf of the NAACP. And of course, there was always media coverage because it was newsworthy at that time. My efforts from that point moved into returning to school, writing the book on which the movie was based. I eventually went into journalism as a contributing editor to the Ladies' Home Journal magazine. All of those activities gave me an opportunity, a platform for saying many things that I wanted to say and do. I became very involved in politics. I ran for Congress in California at a time when women were not were just beginning to run for public office. So all of those volunteer activities, the writing, etc., was a vehicle, or they served as vehicles for me to continue to address not only Medgar, what he stood for, what he had lived and died for, but also to help broaden my perspective and develop my own talents and whatnot. The book certainly served as another reminder to the public. I can say today, unfortunately, there was no vehicle that was named for Medgar that bore his name that could stand for man to see or to remember. So it's been a constant, if you will, flurry of activities working with different organizations and through my own growth and participation that has kept Medgar's name before the public.
What do you think he would have thought of your activism and your starring role in your life that you had taken after being the supportive behind-the-scenes person for so many years?
I know he would have been absolutely delighted. I was a music major. And when we met, both of us were students at Alcorn College in Lyman, Mississippi. And over the years, he would tell me, "Merle, you have talent. You know, use it." He was always pushing me to do, always encouraging me to do. And we had decided that, within that next year, I would have returned to school because we had planned that. He knew that I was ready to step out beyond the supportive role. And he often said, "I'll have to watch you because once you make up your mind, you'll be out there in front of me and I'll have to pull you back." Jokingly, because Metcalf was very much, if I can say, a feminist. He believed in women utilizing their talents and building on them. And as I said, he was very supportive and encouraging in that area. And I know he would just be delighted.
Merle Evers is my guest, if you're just joining us. As you explained, you came from a community in which you didn't really grow up protesting against or even questioning that much the kind of segregation that existed. Mm-hmm. You grew up with it and were used to it. And it was after meeting Medgar Evers that you started becoming, well, more of an
vocal?
Activist and vocal.
Yes.
Yeah. What was that confrontation like where your perceptions started changing and you started seeing things around you differently?
Well, those perceptions came to me really as a young girl, even before I was a teenager. One cannot live in a society that is separated by color without being acutely aware that something is amiss, because I have never a day in my life felt inferior or felt that I should be a second-class citizen. Never, ever. And I would ask my family members, you know, "Well, why can't I do this? Why can't I go to the ballet? Or why can't I go to that school? Why is it that I have to walk some 10, 12 blocks, 2 or 3 miles past a school that is closest to me? Why do I have to ride in the back of the bus with the screen separating me from the other people? Why is it that I can't go to libraries and check out books?" You simply cannot live in that kind of surroundings and atmosphere without asking and without challenging at all. It just so happened that I was told that I could achieve anything that I wanted to as long as I remained in that separate framework. And I guess perhaps the whole issue of race came to me when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And I lived in a neighborhood where on one side of the block of the street, the blacks lived. Across the street, whites lived. And as young children will do, we played together. And one day, one of my playmates, who was white, and I had an argument and a fight, physical fight, as children will do. And from that day on, I was told that I could no longer play with her or she with me. And we had been such good friends. And evidently her parents had told her the same thing. And our friendship turned into a type of cold, glaring kind of dislike for each other with no words spoken. And perhaps that was the one time that really struck me how very separate we were and how deeply entrenched feelings were. Now, I had been certainly called derogatory names and had suffered all of the, and had watched my parents suffer all of the indignities. But that was a very personal thing there. And from there on, I began to question much more openly, and I could never get answers from my parents. And I was 17 years old when I met Medgar, and that was a turning point. because not only would he talk about it, not only would he allow me to talk about it, but he also had answers, and he provided direction.
Can you recall the days when the tactics were being worked on for how to organize the community and what actions to take to desegregate places?
Yes, I can. When Medgar and I opened up the NAACP state office in Mississippi, things were already very much, or the move or the struggle was still very, very much a part of our lives. Before Medgar accepted that job, he had applied to the University of Mississippi School of Law and had been turned down, naturally. We both worked for an insurance company that was black-owned. We had gone on to numerous plantations. Medgar was selling not only insurance policies, but he was also selling NAACP memberships. And I could see the organizing abilities that he had. He was very good with people. He was able to pinpoint community leaders, pull them together, and start discussing and laying plans, if you will, for action in the various communities. And I have often described him as a general, a strategist, who believed in well-developed plans before jumping into a war. And I watched him organize people throughout the state. I watched them define the areas that they were going to tackle first and how they were going to do it. All behind that being the encouragement of our people to register and to vote. And you must remember that people were very, very afraid to do that then, and they had every right to be, because it could mean the loss of lives, loss of jobs, loss of family members. When one's name was printed in the newspaper, if one participated in any of those activities at all, where people lost their homes because their mortgages were called in. I watched the emphasis on registration and voting and economic development emerge from all of those actions. And it was a community-based thing, almost a block-by-block kind of development. And it had to work in that way because there had to be codes, too, that we all understood. For instance, I never knew exactly where Medgar was going to be, particularly in the Delta of Mississippi. He could not tell me. He could not tell me because he was afraid that if by chance someone really wanted to know where he was and they came to me, that through some means or the other, I would be forced to tell. And these were times when there were lynchings and whatnot, and he was investigating them with other people in the local areas. So we had codes. We knew our phones were tapped. We knew we were being, that we were under surveillance. And we talked in code. And I knew when he was all right, and I knew the general area in which he was going to be. It was really a kind of, I look back on it now and can say, an exciting underground type of movement. And it had to be conducted in that manner initially. It was also extremely difficult to get any kind of press out of the state, because you could never be sure that your telegrams would be delivered. You always knew that your phone messages or phone conversations were going to be tapped. And I can recall when we even planted false information by phone, conversing with other people, and then finding something happened that directly related to that conversation when it actually was not factual. So, I mean, it was a very interesting, challenging time, one when people were afraid, and we all were afraid and had every right to be, but also knowing full well that we had to try to break through that cotton curtain, if you will, and let the rest of the world know what was happening there, and that we had to be a united group and had to motivate other people to step beyond that fear. And that's very, very difficult when you're telling someone you've got to register and vote, knowing full well that you might be shot down at the courthouse steps, and that's exactly what happened to some of the people. But it was a movement. It was a time of strength and unity and meeting daily and nightly to develop a plan of action, and it was very exciting.
You were, I'm sure, not only afraid for your husband's life and for your own safety, but for your children's, since they had to go to school every day and mingle with other children. And your name was very well known. What were your fears for your children, and how did that affect your feelings about the family's activism?
Well, a decision had been made, and I get back to that scene that I talked about, that I fought to have placed in the movie. When Medgar told me that I was the one who had to decide, because his decision was made, once I made that decision, there was no turning back, and I never looked back after that point. But one is concerned about one's own safety, but I think even more so about one's children. Medgar was a very, very good father. He was an excellent teacher. He had a marvelous way of dealing with the problems and what he was doing and being able to talk to our children in a manner in which they would understand. He played games with them, such as where's the safest place in the house if shots are fired, that kind of thing, and they all decided that perhaps the bathtub was. Those kinds of things. They went to mass meetings with us. They grew up in that, so they saw that kind of activism. They were with their father in his office when the students who sat in some of the five and dime stores had been beaten and whatnot. They saw those kinds of things when they asked why they could not go to a movie. We took the time to explain to them, hopefully in a manner in which they could understand and relate it to Medgar's work and whatnot. So, and I tried to provide the anchor for them, being at home, including them in all of the activities, and trying to build as normal a life as possible for them. And I will add this, that regardless of where Medgar was in the state of Mississippi, he always made it home to see the children in their plays, in their performances and whatnot. That was something that he almost always did. So they had a normal but non-normal life. But we were a very solid family, not to say that we didn't have our arguments and our ups and downs, but we were pulled closer by all of the threats of death and whatnot that were there.
In your book, For Us the Living, you wrote that Medgar Evers had mixed feelings about the sit-ins when this started happening.
Somewhat. And I will go back to saying that Medgar was a strategist. He was caught for only a moment between whether there should be sit-ins or whether the role should become very active-oriented or legal, if you will, the legal route. Because, after all, he was employed by the NAACP, and the NAACP was emphasizing that we must go through the legal process. And he realized that the legal process would take much, much too long, and that we would not be able to accomplish the things that we needed so desperately to accomplish going through the legal way, and also that people were beginning to get just a little tired of it. The momentum was building and building and building, and our youth, who really were very critical of their elders for not being actively participants, active participants, were beginning to surge ahead. And Medgar did not want them hurt. I think that was more of his concern than anything else. He did not want them physically abused or killed or whatnot, because that had happened to the sit-ins at the library and the sit-ins at the Five and Dime stores. And he did not want that. But he also knew that there was a movement of the young people that he was going to have to move in and work with them in the best manner possible, and also bring the elders in. And he realized himself that the legal way at that particular time had run its course, and that the movement was moving more into the streets. So he was caught in a way, and as I said, for only a moment, because the national office of the NAACP said it must be legal. And the people were saying, we can't wait on the legal system. And that's where the conflict was in terms of his job, not in terms of the man himself.
So did the job have to win out as far as the image that he presented?
No. No, he took a very firm stand on that. And there was a very heated debate between he and the national office the few weeks before his death as to the procedure.
And he was definitely leaning towards the sit-ins and
oh, yes.
And
definitely.
Actions, yeah.
Yes.
I was really surprised to hear that there were blackouts. I didn't know about this in the local TV affiliates.
There are so many things that I guess some people have forgotten, and others who were not a part of that time don't know about. Yes, there were blackouts, media blackouts. The newspapers were owned by Mississippians, and they printed whatever they chose to print, family-owned newspapers. Their editorials, front-page editorials, bounded either in red or black. I'll use this as an example, said that blood was going to flow in the street. And they would specifically name Medgar and other activists like Aaron Henry and others there in the state who were well known. But they refused to print anything in terms of the lynchings, in terms of the jobs lost. I mean, it was so one-sided. Our side was never told within the state papers, but the movement side was told abroad. When I say abroad, I mean in states, certainly in the northern states, New York, New York Times, others that covered that. But getting to the television coverage, at that time, to see a black person on the screen was very rare, as it's becoming rare today too. But so much for that. But it was very, very rare. And any time that there was a person, certainly of note, and those were the only ones who were on then, such as a Roy Wilkins or a Lena Horne or a Thurgood Marshall, the screen would simply go black with no indication what had happened, that there was never a sign that said temporary difficulties beyond our control or something. The screen would simply go black until those people were off, and then the program would continue.
Where did you find out information about what was happening through other states? Through other people in the NAACP, were you able to get in outside?
Oh, what was happening in other states? Well, the newspapers and the media covered that. The difficulty was getting out to the rest of American society what was happening in Mississippi to blacks. It was no real difficulty in getting information in terms of what was happening around the rest of the world to us. But that it was always, the articles of whatnot were always very carefully, I can't say edited, but very selective in terms of what was included in the newspaper and what was not.
Do you think the national press was effective in covering what was happening?
Once the national press really began to focus on it, I think they did a very good job of covering it. I'm sure if I were to go back through clippings or whatnot, I could probably find some articles or reporting techniques that I did not care for.
Do you think your husband had premonitions of his death?
I know he did. We both did. And not to say that either of us was psychic, just wise in dealing with reality. Medgar was the focal point for all of the activities. He was the one person who spoke and represented the black and the people, the black people of that state. And when the economic boycott was so successful, we both knew then that something was going to happen. When the feelings reached such a fever pitch on both sides, we knew that something was bound to happen. And he talked to me about the possibility of his not being around. I tried to reassure him that that was not going to be the case, that he would be, that he was too well known, that certainly they would not do anything to him, knowing full well that because he was so well known and he was a spokesperson, that he would be the natural target for it. So we both knew, and I guess within the last couple of weeks before his death, we stopped trying to reassure each other that it was not going to happen and simply clung to each other for strength and support during the rest of the time that he had.
Was his assassin ever found?
I believe that the assassin was found. The man was the accused assassin, was brought to trial twice. Both times it ended in a hung jury. Each time the man received a hero's welcome from his home people. And beyond that, which I think is something of the ultimate slap, maybe it's the ultimate in democracy, I don't know which, he ran for lieutenant governor of the state. And fortunately, he did not win. But his whole theme was that he had ridded the state of unneeded varmints. And it was his gift to the state of Mississippi. And that's what he ran on.
What were your reactions to the more radical groups of the 60s as they developed? I'm thinking of SNCC and then the Black Panther Party. What did you think of the tactics that they were using?
Perhaps initially I questioned those tactics because I had been so involved with the NAACP, and I really saw that organization as the organization. And I think it's only normal, it's only human not to want anyone else to come in and take over some of what you have built up. There was that kind of curiosity about the organizations when they first began. But quickly, I realized, and I think others who had questioned their being, was that it takes all kinds of organizations, and it also takes all kinds of approaches to focus in on a cancer such as racism and attack it from many different angles, because in so doing, whereas we had been called radicals Sneck and some of the others came along, and they were then called radicals, which supported us in doing perhaps some things with less notice and attention that we were able to get done that we possibly would not have been able to have gotten done, at least not at that time, had the other organizations not diverted the media's attention and whatnot. I think it's necessary to have different approaches to a single question, to a single issue, to a single illness. And that's about it. We need different approaches, and I'm all for that.
You're now working in the business world. You're now the director of consumer affairs at ARCO.
Yes.
Some people would think that it's, quote, selling out to go from the civil rights movement to the corporate world and to be the director of community affairs and then consumer affairs for a large multinational oil company. How do you feel about that?
I say hogwash to that. That is not necessarily so, and it certainly is not so in my case. There were young people who had worked for me during my campaign, and they could not understand how that had happened. My son, my eldest son, was the first one to approach me about that when I told him that I was going into a business, and he said, "How could you?" You know, or "How can you?" it was at the time. And I said, "Easily, because I have to put you through college." But then I spent the time with him to explain that I had done a great deal of research in terms of companies based in Los Angeles or in Southern California, where we were located. And I had focused on those companies that had a very, very strong and positive image in terms of social corporate responsibility. I had also talked to friends that I had in a number of different companies, as I certainly did with ARCO, and found that it had by far the best reputation, that top management certainly emphasized and supported all of those efforts, and that being employed by such a company with such positions would allow me the opportunity to do things to help people and organizations that I could not do on my own because I didn't have the money.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and
your
work. Thanks very much for being here.
It's been a pleasure.